I'm Kate Remington talking with Jonathan Yates, the conductor of the Norwalk Symphony Orchestra, about an epic performance coming up on May 20th, Mahler's Resurrection Symphony. And Jonathan, wow, I'm so happy to have a chance to talk with you about this piece.
Oh, me too, Kate. I'm always thrilled to come in and chat with you, and then to get to talk about Mahler too, of all pieces. And you nailed it on the head. The word is epic.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And you're performing with the Mendelssohn Choir,
That's right.
And spectacular soloists.
You got it.
It's such an event because this work is performed live so rarely.
That's exactly right. I mean, just because it requires such massive forces. And so, I mean, it's hard for me to contain my enthusiasm about it, I have to say. When personally, you know, if there is a performance of Mahler 2, I am there. So, and this is my first time out with the work, doing it with the Norwalk Symphony and this great choir. And we're all so thrilled.
I really bet. Yeah. Well, I guess I'll start with it. How do you get in shape for something like this mentally and physically?
Well, you start studying that score as early as humanly possible, first of all. You know, is it maybe 300 pages? It's something to that effect. It's just massive. And there are a lot of logistical issues too, right? Because there are offstage trumpeters and offstage horns and offstage percussions, and the question of how you deal with a chorus. So that actually has to be dealt with fairly early. And then it's just a matter of developing a relationship with the score as quickly as humanly possible, because it's so personal, the work. I mean, and that's what makes Mahler so special, is that it's so self-expressive for Mahler. And so then it's a way of interpreting that in a way of envisioning what his specific feel for the work is as well.
I think for a lot of people, Mahler symphonies are a little bit intimidating because they are so massive. And yet it's kind of like, I guess, visiting a national park, because,
that's,
you know,
exactly
the huge
right.
scope of it is enormous. But then you start focusing on kind of the small details that make it just so interesting.
Well, that's exactly right. And I would say to any listeners, if for whatever reason you haven't heard a Mahler symphony before, if you are, in fact, a little daunted, do not be. There is nothing to fear. It is, I will not lie, it is 80 minutes of music, but it is scintillating. He has you from the moment he starts to the moment he stops. And the thing is, it's this incredibly compelling narrative, right? Where you begin with death, literally, and you end in resurrection. And he just takes you on this massive journey with, again, these massive forces. I mean, and just the sheer joy of seeing so many people on stage at any given point is just so incredible. And to begin where you begin, in the pits of despair, and to end with this total exaltation. It's just one of the most riveting experiences out there, you know? It really is.
Yeah, and he provided such a detailed program for it, too, with the first movement, as you say, really being about death. In fact, I just found this out. He intended it to be the funeral march for the hero of the first
That's
symphony,
exactly right.
Which is so cool.
That's exactly right. So, you know, it's hard to talk about the narrative without talking about Beethoven as well, because Beethoven, he looms so large, right, over Mahler, over Brahms, over anybody in the German tradition of symphonic writing. And what Mahler does is take the narrative of something like Beethoven 5, which goes also from tragedy to triumph, and makes it that much more personal. So he, like Beethoven, basically envisions himself as a hero. You know, they're not men with small egos, but thank God for it, because it means that the works that they write are that much more epic. And what he really learns from Beethoven is this idea of self-expression through music. You know, that music, it doesn't necessarily even need to be pretty, but it needs to just express the deepest emotional truth. And so you begin with just horror, you know, because the hero of the first symphony, and really the first and second symphony do go together, is now on basically a funeral pyre. And you begin with this incredibly intense cello riff, this yuggadadum, yuggadadum, where literally it's almost like the orchestra is barking at you. And for 20 minutes, you are just, again, on the edge of your seat in kind of terror, you know? And the terror is so dramatic that Mahler actually insists on a 5-minute pause after the first movement because he knew it had that kind of emotional impact.
It's such a prologue to the rest of the symphony, but it's not like any of the other movements. So
no, it's each individual movement really stands apart, and yet together they create this incredibly cohesive, incredibly exciting narrative. And it's five movements, which is unusual for a symphony, right? Normally you get four. And what happens is you start with death, literally, and then Mahler looks, as the hero looks back on his life. And so you get the second and third movements, which are sort of opposing narratives, opposing viewpoints on what life was like. And the second one is just loveliness. It's just, it's nostalgic in the way that one thinks of nostalgia.
Well, and it's also nostalgic because he uses the Austrian Ländler.
That's exactly right.
And it has such a wonderful quietness to it and a delicacy that is fabulous antidote to the terror of the first
That's
movement.
Exactly right. And it's warm and it's loving and you just sit and you kind of bask in it. And then he gives you kind of the other side of life, right, in the third movement, which is sardonic and a little bit nasty even. And it's based on an earlier song of his, St. Anthony of Padua preaching to the fishes or something to that effect. And the text is so great because it's taken from Des Knaben Wunderhorn, because it's talking about how beautiful the sermon is, and you know the fish are moved, and the eels are moved, and the crabs are moved, and this is moved, and then they all go back to life the way it was, and it has no impact on them whatsoever. So what you get is you hear actually the undulating of the sea in the music. But at the same time, it has this nasty undercurrent because it's basically spirituality has no meaning, you know, and that then, you know, and you hear hints of what will be something like Shostakovich, you know, that kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah, that dark, really sarcastic quality.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then we turn away from life and we start our move to resurrection with Urlicht.
That is just the most incredible. It's almost like time stands still in that movement, because it's not like I read he changes meter.
That's exactly
like
right.
A million times.
That's right. Well, and you know we think about mixed meter as the you know as something that 20th century composers and 21st century composers do. And what's crazy about Urlicht is it just moves from, you know, 4/4 to 5/4 to 3/4 and back and forth. And it's, 30 some odd bars only. And it is one of the most beautiful utterances in all of classical music. And Urlicht means literally primal light. Yeah. And you have for the first time, I think, really in a symphony where it's really an art song in a symphony, you know, with this really beautiful chamber accompaniment. You know, of course, there are soloists in Beethoven 9, but in this case, you have a movement that revolves entirely around the mezzo soloist, and she is just there, and he picks the sound of the mezzo really for kind of an earth mother mm-hmm. sort of feel.
Yeah.
You know, it's to just sort of fill you with warmth, and oh boy, does it ever.
Yeah, and it has a wonderful naive quality to it, like a lot of the Wunderhorn settings, and it's just, yeah, like you say, it's this amazing moment, and then
Judgment Day. Well, and then she really sets you up for because she says, you know, whatever life brings you, mm-hmm. you know that there is hope with the angels, and yeah, it's also what you get a little bit in the Fourth Symphony, and then just out of nowhere, the skies open.
Yeah, yeah, it's like chaos. It's like the chaos movement of Beethoven's Ninth.
That's exactly right. And I mean, I have to tell you my own personal story with this movement. I worked with Ben Zander, who conducts the Boston Phil, and he brought me out to see the concert. He's a big Mahlerian. He did Mahler 2 in Worcester. And he brought me out, and, you know, the chorus stands up at the, well, not at the beginning of the movement, but when that terrifying music returns, and they kind of ambled up the first time. And he said, no. You know, you must be up like jackrabbits. And they, in the concert, they shot up. And I thought the angels from the proscenium were going to go shooting into the theater. It was so terrifying.
Oh my God.
But that's the effect.
Yeah, yeah.
Of that music. It's Judgment Day, and there are, you know, there's offstage trumpet calls and offstage horn calls because, again, you know, it's, you have the sense of this world of judgment,
yeah, yeah.
You know? And, you know, it's funny, he struggled with it because he didn't want to do sort of Beethoven 9 Part 2,
right,
or Beethoven 9 the sequel. And he knew that by having a chorus in there, like Beethoven does, that was the danger of it. But he went to Hans von Bülow's funeral, right? And they had this beautiful early setting of this sort of resurrection text. And he went, oh my God, this is my answer. This is, you know, this is the answer to the narrative of the symphony. It begins with death and it ends with resurrection. And the first time the chorus comes in, you know, Mahler actually specifically instructs them to remain seated because it's so quiet and so beautiful and so intimate, you know, these heavenly, heavenly voices that you just, I think he really wants the audience to almost lean in.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, just to get a sense of that specific color.
Well, and to have them all stand up when they come in would be such a disruption.
Well, that's exactly right.
Yeah, because he was such a good conductor, too. I mean,
of course,
really knew how an orchestra works. Well, and he was able to put that in his music, too.
That's exactly right. And he always was thinking outside the box. Do you know what I mean? This is not a composer who is sort of looking to just kind of go with traditional forms and be content with that. I mean, he's always thinking about instruments that have never been used before. In this, there's the ruta, which is a bunch of sticks held together, literally. I mean, in the later symphonies, there are the huge hammer clashes, right? This is one of, for me, the most exciting things about Mahler, actually. What I think he really gets from Beethoven is he is there to just, like, take no names. You know, any boundary, any barrier, he's there to break it.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that makes the music so exciting, where you can have all these musicians and all this chorus. The reason you can have such a massive symphony and have it work is because he's willing to take you to places that other composers wouldn't take you, so that you can have an 80-minute work and be absolutely on the edge of your seat the entire time, you know?
Yeah, I know. There's not a dull moment at
no.
all. Or the ones that are, that give you a little bit of breathing space to kind of just come down a little bit, are there exactly at the right moments. And then when the chorus comes in the last part of the last movement, I mean, he really keeps us waiting for the big payoff,
yeah.
and it's just like, wow, it's
right.
Mind-blowing.
And
really.
Then the payoff is, I have to say, maybe the best payoff in any symphony ever.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, which is saying a lot, but it really, it's as good as it gets for payoff, because it ends with, again, these massive choral forces. And I have to recommend, actually, to any of your listeners, you can just Google, or you go to YouTube, rather, I'm sorry, and if you look up Bernstein and Mahler 2 ending, just for a sense of the incredible uplift, you know, the incredible joy. You just don't want to miss this experience. I mean, as a conductor, as a musician, as an audience member, as a chorister, as a soloist, I mean, it's just to get to that point, it's really, it is a transformational work, you know. It really is. It merits the title Resurrection.
Yeah, which actually was a title that he wasn't. He
a little
it,
ambivalent
but, yeah.
about, right? Yeah. I know. Well, you know, like any great musician, though, there's always ambivalence about putting a really literal program on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
There's a sense that you want it to transcend anything that you can put into words.
Right. Yeah. Which is why he brings the chorus in too, because it's like instruments. parents just aren't enough.
That's exactly right. And I mean, and you know, even though the texts refer to resurrection, I think there's a sense that there's something much more universal going on.
Yeah,
you
definitely.
Know what I mean?
Yeah.
That it's, and you know, later in life when he uses texts from, you know, Eastern Asian mysticism and things, his interests, they're so broad and so humane. You know, and that's what, no matter what sort of your own spiritual feelings and beliefs, it's there for you,
mm-hmm.
regardless. You know, Mahler II it's for everyone, that piece. It really is.
Yeah, it's going to be such a special event. And Jonathan, thank you so much for this is the tip of the iceberg here, but thanks so much for coming in and telling us about it.
Always a treat. Thank you so much for having me.